The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi guys, we want to thank our great sponsor, Legion M. They are the first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They create really incredible experiences for people. If you're someone who wants to feel like you own a piece and are a piece of the industry, it's a great way to do it. They do meetups all over the country. They have a really cool community going online. I cannot recommend them enough. Go to legionm.com for more information.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And I met our next guest at the TCM Classic Film Festival just weeks ago. And I said, I had such a good time with her. I said, would you come on our podcast? And she happily said yes.
Fool.
I'm so honored.
We're the ones who are honored. Tracy Nelson.
Hello.
Hello there.
Everyone's going, who the heck is that?
Well,
please. Please.
We met because there was a screening of the lovely movie Yours, Mine, and Ours from 1968 with Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda, which really holds up. It's a sweet little film.
It does. I was surprised,
actually. The audience enjoyed it thoroughly, and so did I. And I hadn't seen it since it was new.
Oh, my gosh.
And we had three of the young cast members, right, the children from the film, now grown, of course. And you were the youngest.
I was the second of the youngest. I was North Beardsley, right? Yes,
yeah.
Beardsley.
One of Henry Fonda's
yes,
kids
thank you.
In the film.
And I was a quick carry-on, kind of a stunt baby. it was so nice to be part of that experience. And what's so amazing is that people who actually love movies.
Yeah.
You know, and you can always tell in a theater where people are actually paying attention and really. The first time I saw a movie in Manhattan, I was up in Harlem. I think it was Fatal Attraction. And it was an interactive experience.
Sure.
You know? It was crazy, and people were throwing stuff at the screen and screaming at each other, and my friend that I was with, who was from New York, started screaming at the girl next to her, and they had a fight, and I was like, what is happening? And in LA, there's sort of a reverence for film, and especially so when people are actually coming to see beautiful movies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's some of us who were, I mean, listen, you know, kids can be rowdy and audiences can be rowdy at different times. But there are some of us who believe that the motion picture theater at its finest is kind of a cathedral in a way.
Absolutely.
You know, and
it's
you go into the dark and you know,
right.
And it is a sacred space.
And that's why it's so frustrating. You know, everyone gets screeners for the Oscars and things like that.
Yeah.
I feel bad for the DPs, for all the cinematographers who are doing this incredible work.
I will say, though, that part of that is and this is a whole other conversation, but, you know, a lot of times now, that's what we're offered for screenings in general.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's like, but that's surely not how everyone that worked on this movie wants us to see it.
Absolutely
you
not.
Know?
Absolutely
and we
not.
Don't want to watch
be,
it like
it should
that.
Be, you should get a ticket or something.
I want to. I'd rather, in some cases, we'd rather wait until it actually comes out.
Yeah.
Because if the only option is to watch it on my computer, I'd really rather not.
And it's, you know, film, I think, is meant to be an immersive experience.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it feels safe. You don't have to worry about your kids coming in talking about homework or your dog's barking or, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It shouldn't be distractions like that.
Yeah.
Now, when I asked you how you happened to be at age four in Yours, Mine, and Ours, you gave me a perfectly logical answer that opens a door to what we're going to discuss in part today. Please tell us how you happened to be in that movie.
Well, and it actually relates to what we were just talking about because I'm seventh generation, actually, performer.
Seventh.
My yeah, there's goodness. Vaudeville and circus and all kinds of stuff on my grandma Harriet's side. But my family had a television show called The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, my grandparents. And my dad was on that show. Kind of, he wasn't playing himself, but he was called the same thing. And his name was Rick Nelson. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I'm very proud of my dad. But the reason I was in that movie was because Harriet, my grandma, who I was really close to, she and I shared an apartment for a while. We were like the odd couple. It was pretty funny. She used to say, you know, honey, if you were alive in the 30s in New York, we would have raised some hell. I just love that so much. But she was at RKO with Lucy and Ginger, and she was very good friends with Ginger Rogers her whole life. Mm-hmm. I know you enjoy Ginger Rogers mm-hmm, a lot. Mm-hmm. And I have a picture to show you guys, which is completely irrelevant on a podcast. But
it's okay. We have one for you, too.
Okay. But, yeah, Lucy was friends with Harriet, and I guess it was sort of a rumor that they were doing this. She was doing a movie with Henry Fonda, and they needed all these kids. Because the story of the movie is that Henry has a million children. I think it's like 12 or something. And Lucy has 10, and they get married. And shenanigans ensue. So they needed, you know, stunt babies. So I was four, actually. And I have not a whole lot of memories except, as I said at your event, Lucy was very scary to me. I know she was a wonderful lady. Her daughter and I know each other, and mm-hmm. I love Lucy, the young Lucy.
Lucy Arnaz, yeah.
Yes, and Luckin' Bill, yeah. Mm-hmm. And but she, you know, Lucille Ball had so much presence, and you know, when you're a child and you walk, you feel that kind of like a dog feels mm-hmm. the energy of someone. And she just, well, every time she walked in a room, you know, everything sort of stopped, and so you kind of are aware of that, not knowing what's going on. And then she has this crazy red hair, like so red it was just insane to me, and this voice, this smoker's voice, and I it was, you know, as a little child, she scared me a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And the red lipstick. Well, everyone had red lipstick then, but Henry Fonda, on the other hand, was very much like my own dad, very quiet, soft-spoken, kind of a gentle presence. Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of clung to him the whole time. And, yeah, so I don't have much to say about that experience.
But I didn't put two and two together.
But you just said Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball, that's a lot. No,
okay.
I didn't put two and two together that your grandma, Harriet Hilliard at the time.
Yes.
Was at RKO. Mm-hmm. She's in Follow the Fleet with Fred and Ginger.
And that's how she met Ginger, right. Mm-hmm.
And among other movies. And that Lucy was just starting out at that time. She's in Stage Door with Ginger Rogers, Katharine Hepburn.
Stage Door is one of my favorite movies
ever. Well, it's a great movie, and it's got a killer cast.
And thank God they never tried to remake it.
Don't say it out loud. Don't say it
out loud.
So many people in that movie, Ann Miller, Eve Arden, the cast just doesn't quit. And they're all great.
Yeah.
And so that I have a
story to tell you about that. Sorry.
Please do.
No, you know, they basically wanted to cast pretty much all RKO girls for mm-hmm. that film. And my grandmother was in contention for the lead role. And please, what is her name? Gloria, the actress who won I believe she won the Oscar for playing the lead, for playing Kay, the one who kills herself.
Oh, Andrea Leeds.
Oh, thank you. She was in contention for that mm-hmm. role. And there was a certain executive that she would not fool around with mm-hmm. when asked. Mm-hmm. So that was always her story about that whole mm-hmm. thing. But imagine being sort of on the set with those people, and Katharine Hepburn, of course. Yeah. And I told you at the AMC thing, you know, Katharine Hepburn used to sit on the curb at RKO and read her fan mail in pants, you know, which was very scandalous. Kind of her legs sort of like, you know, like a guy just kind of sitting there reading. And Grandma thought she was a huge show-off, so she'd kind of very properly sort of walk by, and one day Katharine Hepburn said to her, just didn't even look up, just said, "I hear you're good," to my grandmother, and she just kind of looked down and said, "That remains to be seen, Miss Hepburn," and just kept walking. But the thought of all those people sort of in the same place.
I can't.
You know?
Oh, man.
And I got to tell you, you know, for your audience, I came here yesterday because I thought it was yesterday that we were doing this. And it wasn't, of course. So I was feeling like a stalker, as I mentioned to you guys earlier. But I kind of was kind of roaming around Hollywood before I had to go back over the hill. And, you know, just you feel the ghosts, sort of the I don't want to say ghosts, not in a bad way, but you feel that the spirit of all of those people and the dreams of everybody. As soon as you drive over Highland, you know, mm-hmm. you, don't you think? You just feel it coming from, you know, I grew up actually right up on, can you tell I had a lot of coffee this morning? Nichols Canyon, mm-hmm. right up here. And my dad used to put me on the motorcycle and take me down to Schwab's over here. We'd have milkshakes. And so, like, to be in this area, you know, I was saying I visited my dad's guitars and guitar center yesterday. And it just feels like home to be here.
Sure. Yeah. But it's, again, just to, just to sort of reemphasize or perhaps reemphasize, your father was Ricky Nelson.
Yes.
Ricky Nelson.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a big, he is still a big deal.
Yeah.
And I mean, you come from, you have great bloodlines, Tracy.
Thank you.
If you were a poodle, you'd win.
Oh, gosh.
But you do, you know, and you know, we just interviewed Angie Dickinson, who, of course,
was in Rio Bravo.
Rio Bravo, yep. Yes. Yep. And in which your dad co-starred with John Wayne,
yeah,
and Dean Martin,
and my dad was in love with her on that film.
Yeah,
and you know the greatest thing about that movie, I think, was Howard Hawks. For my dad, was mm-hmm. Howard Hawks really believed in him as an actor, and he, you know, they cast him because he was a hit on a TV series, mm-hmm. And you know, after watching some of the film, he said, you know, you have that thing that you can't train yourself into on film. You either have that thing or you don't. And he said, I think you could be a really good actor with some training, mm-hmm. and I'm willing to sponsor you at the Actors Studio.
Wow.
And my dad, you know, Ozzy kind of said to him, well, that was my grandfather, you know, you have this crew and you have all these people that are depending on you, and if you leave, they're going to cancel the show. So he didn't end up going to New York,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is great for me, because had he wouldn't have met my mom and I wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
He had such a great experience because it was such a safe environment with such a strong, great director.
Yeah.
You know, I love how Howard Hawks, I love how he just sits the camera down and he lets the action happen. And there aren't many directors now at all, you know, who are that confident.
Confident is the word.
Yeah. You're confident in your script. You're confident in your actors. You're confident in everything about it, that the scene, that doesn't have to be 7,000 jump cuts.
Especially when you're covering, I love musicals. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you're covering dance, preaching to the choir.
You're preaching to the choir with my daughter.
Let
me
tell you how angry these things make. No. I'm raised on Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, Gene Kelly, the best, basically.
Right.
The best. And what's one of the first things you learn about Fred Astaire? It's in his contract. He had to be shot head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
Head to toe, whole thing.
Oh, see, I didn't know it was in his contract.
That
explains a lot.
Because then you can see him dancing.
Doing. Yeah.
And the thing I referenced,
as he used to say, I don't dance with my feet.
No.
I dance with my whole body.
Yeah, absolutely. Who wants to watch? They're there. And so the key example that I always say to people is Richard Gere. They made this whole fuss that for Chicago, he took 6 months of tap dance lessons.
Yeah.
Watch the movie where it's his face, his feet,
Don't even get me started.
Who the hell knows? I can't stand it. But it's just like, what's the point, though?
Yeah.
What's the point of having anyone do anything if you're not going to see them doing it?
Exactly.
You know?
Well, plus, I was a dancer for a long time, 17 years of ballet, and I am a huge fan of dance in general, all kinds of dance. And when you're creating the work, you're creating lines.
Oh, yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And when you're watching it as an audience, you're seeing head to foot. That's how it's meant to be seen. So, you know, I just what was I watching just recently? Knowing I was coming.
Yeah. Everything that we watch is doing this now, and it drives me insane.
You know, Grandma used to talk about Ginger rehearsing with Fred.
I have the mm-hmm. biggest girl crush on that woman my whole life.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story about that, about Ginger and my grandma. My grandmother and I was on a regular on a really bad Aaron Spelling series whose name will not be mentioned.
Okay.
I think it was in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
God, I'm so old.
please.
And Grandma, I really loved working with her. We did it a couple of times. So she came in and she just did a day on this thing. And while we were on the studio, on the lot, Ginger came by, had heard Grandma was there. And she was in a chair at that time and she had her attendant. And they just had this huge, you know, reunion. They hadn't seen each other in a long time. And I got to be the fly on the wall and listen to this amazing conversation where Ginger basically was sort of pouring out her heart to Grandma and saying, you know, darling, she called her darling, we made different choices, and you made a choice to have a family and really be that woman, and I made a different choice, and now here you are with your granddaughter, and you have, and she was I'm sad to even talk about it, because she was sort of sad about it, you know. But Katharine Hepburn used to always say, you know, you can't do both really well. Mm. And I argue with people all the time, because it's really hard when you're in this business. I mean, when I had my daughter, I had to pretty much stop working because all my work was in Canada. And once she goes to school and I'm a single mom, there's just no way to do it. You mm-hmm. literally physically can't be there.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you make choices, very hard ones sometimes.
Yeah. And Ginger married many times, but never successfully, I guess you might say. They were all fairly short-term relationships.
But Grandma was saying to me that later that she definitely, in those relationships, you know, some women will hang in there and really try to make it work. Mm-hmm. And it's because there's always going to be challenges, no matter who you marry. And other women say, you know, this is not what I have to bring to the planet. I'm an artist, and this is what I'm bringing.
Now, what your grandparents did, though, was so unusual. So unusual.
How did they not kill each other?
Well, let's start with the fact that Ozzie Nelson, a Jersey boy like myself.
Oh, well, from where? Where are you from?
Well, I was born in Manhattan, but I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey.
So did he.
Birthplace of your dad.
Yeah.
Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Yeah. In the Holy Name Hospital. Yep. Of all places.
that's amazing.
That wild, it is amazing. And you know who lived there when I was growing up was another teen idol, Pat Boone.
Pat Boone.
Pat lived in Teaneck anyway. But I digress. Anyhow, Ozzie went to Rutgers University.
Yes.
And that's where he formed his first band.
Wanted to make a little extra money on the weekends.
Yep. And then went professional.
Yeah.
And was a successful band leader. And then hired a pretty and talented young lady named Harriet Hilliard.
He saw her singing at the Cotton Club in mm-hmm. Harlem.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And at the time she had, you know, platinum blonde hair and a satin dress and, you know, with no underwear so you don't see the panty lines. And basically they had a rapport when they met. It wasn't so much about her being a singer. Ozzy used to do this little patter in the middle of his sets. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the college kids would come, because they liked that little thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he found he really got along with Harriet in that way, that sort of pattery kind of way. And that's why he hired her. And they used to do that. And then that expanded into the radio show.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
But before the radio show, even though they were selling hit records
mm-hmm.
and were very, very popular. And they even recorded a song written by my uncle.
Your kid, which one?
Called Don't Count Your Kisses Before You're Kissed.
Wow.
And
my great uncle was named Bernard Malton, and he passed away quite young.
Was he an orchestra leader or a
writer?
No.
He was a studio pianist and sometimes songwriter. And
such a tiny world, isn't it?
It is.
So small.
It is amazing. So Ozzie and Harriet were first paired as colleagues. And how soon did they?
They were friends and on the road together mm-hmm. for a couple of years before they actually, you know, became an item.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Grandma used to always say that was the best way to do it, because you're really best friends with this person, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the golden
thing. That's the dream,
golden thing.
Yeah, and she had been married before, and it hadn't gone well, and she was very sort of iffy about doing it again. Plus, she had this sort of burgeoning career in film and with Follow the Fleet, and she wanted to play that out a little bit, and he just made the decision. She used to say, I just decided to hitch my wagon to that star, you know, and they had this, I've been wearing lately the last, because I'm writing about them right now a little bit.
Good.
And I've been wearing this thing that I have around my neck, which again, your poor audience cannot see.
But we can describe.
Okay. Mm-hmm. They're these little, whenever they would have something important would happen or an argument would happen, my grandpa would give her a dozen red roses with these silver charms that he had made at Napier's over in Beverly Hills in the old days. And they had something kind of witty inscribed on them. And she gave them to me when she passed away. And my favorite one is, Roses are red, violets are blue. Same damn roses for the same damn you. Darling, keep your chin up and your breakfast down. That's when she was pregnant. You know, and each one is very special, and that's kind of the relationship they had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a very good sort of template for how to.
Yeah.
Know. Because I honestly don't know. I mean, Lucy and Desi are another good example, but they had a much more tempestuous relationship.
Yes, they did. And so what happened was eventually your father and mother settled here in Los Angeles.
Grandmother.
I'm sorry.
I know I'm old.
No, no,
oh,
you
please.
Know, no. It's not you. My brain
no,
is
no,
old.
No, it's okay. It happens all
and
the
I
time.
I keep swapping generations.
What happens when there's seven generations of you?
I keep swapping generations out unwittingly. So your grandparents got married and were working together on radio.
Yes.
Network radio here. And your mom suddenly got experience that I don't think she'd had. She had this charming personality, especially with Ozzy, as you say, with this banter type of repartee. But then she got on the Red Skelton radio show.
Yeah.
And did, she was like a straight woman.
She was a great straight woman.
Mean Widow Kids skits
right.
that he did.
Yeah.
And so when Ozzy and Harriet decided or had the opportunity to go on their own show on radio,
mm-hmm.
it became a really successful situation comedy show.
Mm-hmm.
But that was steered by your grandfather.
Mm. Oh, yeah. He was a very... Grandpa was in charge of every project he did himself. Mm-hmm. And when they finally started doing television, which was a totally pioneer medium, I know this is a film show, but
that's really
the only thing I'm qualified to talk about is TV.
But he did a movie first.
Yes, that's true. He did. Here Come the Nelsons.
He's so smart.
Rock Hudson was in the film, Here Come the Nelsons. It was kind of done as sort of a pilot for the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And the lovely blonde character actress who ended up getting the part, you know who auditioned for that?
No.
Marilyn Monroe.
Huh. Oh, my.
Yeah. Well, not audition. Grandpa didn't believe in auditions. Mm-hmm. He would just sit and talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
He told me once that when they recast, they tried to do a show in the 70s called Ozzy's Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And Sissy Spacek came in,
mm-hmm.
and nobody knew who she was at that time. And he just said he talked to her for a few minutes and ended up saying, you know, you're way too good for this. You've got way better things ahead of you. So don't, you know, I think you're amazing and go find your stardom.
Wow.
Yeah.
So radio was really the birth of Ozzy and Harriet.
Yes.
As a team, as a familiar team. And they played with the format a little bit and then finally hit pay dirt by playing just a slight exaggeration of reality.
Well, it's really interesting, and that's kind of what I've been writing about. It's this idea that there is reality, and then there's what people perceive as reality,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I love about the business the most. I have this great picture of everybody on the set. I think my dad was like 21 or something at the time, and they're having kind of a conversation in the living room, and then there's that picture, and then there's the actual picture, which is much bigger, and you see all the guys in the catwalks, all the guys with the microphones,
mm-hmm.
everybody. So I am, as a grandchild and a daughter, trying to suss that out sometimes is difficult. They play themselves. People assume, people will come up. That's the other difference with TV and film. With, you know, I went to school with a lot of children of film actors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
where'd you go to school?
Buckley.
I went to Buckley.
You did?
I did.
Oh my gosh. Did you graduate from Buckley?
I did.
I went from when it was right over here in Hollywood, Buckley School, till 11th grade and then, or 10th grade, and I went to Westlake.
Sure.
When it was still a girls' school.
When it was still Westlake.
When it was still Westlake.
Yeah.
But as you know, there are a lot of children of working people.
Yes.
And, you know, when someone is a film actor, there's a certain, you know, reverence, like Parents' Day and stuff. You know, you get someone film famous would come in and no one would talk to them. They would sort of stay away. They would, you know. But with my family, there was always this warmth and this like, oh, hey, how you doing? You know, it's a different dynamic because you're in their home.
Well, in their home.
This is
week after week after week.
You'll hear
after
people
week.
Say it because it is the case when someone's in your living room.
Absolutely.
Every week.
And I've got to say, too, I love the fact that my grandparents' show was the first of its kind. It was the first. Grandma always called the other ones, you know, Father Knows Best and all those. They were the copycats
mm-hmm.
because they were the first. And the idea that, like, for example, my dad was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and mm-hmm. I had to come up with, I had to make the speech, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And really what I realized is it was the first time people actually saw and heard someone at the same time. Because this was, you know, 1957, 1956, actually. And people were not used to that. It was the radio or a photograph. You didn't combine the two. And we can't conceive of that now.
Yeah.
But, you know, to see that he kind of smuggled in this certain kind of music that at the time radios were calling race music, he smuggled that into people's homes and made it sort of acceptable. And I think
And that just to explain, for people who are too young.
Of course, sorry.
To have watched Ozzy and Harry. Because if you're of a certain age, you couldn't miss Ozzy and Harriet, the Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet. They were America's first family. They were everybody's idealized American family. And that show ran for eons.
And to this day, though, they are a part of pop culture in terms of references. You'll hear it in music, in shows. They'll say, you know, what are you, Ozzy and Harriet? People may not even know what it was, but they understand what the reference means.
What was the movie that Nicolas Cage did? Raising Arizona?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Saying Ozzy and Harriet.
Yeah. So anyway, they were incredibly, not just successful and famous.
Ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous, yes. Is the word. And loved. Beloved.
Yeah.
They were part of the American culture, the fabric of American life. And on radio, I find this so funny. When they started the show on radio, your dad and your uncle David were too young to play themselves.
Right.
They couldn't read yet or perform yet. So they had young actors playing.
Oh, no, they were. It's just my grandmother didn't want them. They were.
Oh, I misheard it then.
Yeah, they were really anxious to be in the show. In fact, David had been on stage with them since they were doing the band stuff.
Oh, I see.
Wow.
I'm glad you're setting me straight.
No. She just wanted them to sort of, you know, be more regular kind of kids.
Mm-hmm.
She was.
How'd that go? How'd that go for you? Not well.
Well, no.
But eventually they joined the cast.
Yes.
And so there were the four Nelsons, Ozzy, Harriet, David, and Ricky.
Yeah. And you know, did you know that they were the first people to married couple to sleep in the same bed
mm-hmm.
on TV? There's a really great story.
Scandalous.
About, yeah, that Sanders, because Ozzy was given a blank check by the network, which, you know, it's unheard of now. And he owned he was at General Services down here, and the old one, then Zoetrope, then I don't know what it is
now.
Anyway, and he was given this blank check and to make the show, and he kind of controlled the PR. He edited, wrote, directed, acted, did the music.
People don't know this because the Ozzy we saw on
it was
TV.
Kind of a bumbling.
Yeah, was kind of a genial bumbler.
Right.
A very likable bumbler. I told Jesse that Mad Magazine, I think, used to make fun of the TV Guide log lines for a typical episode would be Ozzy loses a button on his cardigan sweater.
Exactly.
You know, that would be a half hour.
No, there's a show. People used to say, "What do you do for work?"
Yeah, what do you do for a living? Yes.
And he used to say, "It's not important. It's about the family." So, like, there are shows titled The Ladder. You know? Which is actually a really funny episode, by the way. But,
so
yeah.
There he was. And although the credits were there to be read at the end, you could read credits in those days.
Yeah.
They didn't flash them in a millisecond.
Or shrink them.
Right. But you could read the credits and learn for yourself that he was not just the star of the show with the rest of his family. He was the producer, the director, and the head writer.
And the editor, and he supervised the music, and he supervised the press.
Mm-hmm.
He was a bit of a workaholic, shall
mm-hmm.
you say. And and Harriet, the other thing that I think so interesting is people say, oh, she was, you know, the perfect mom. And honestly, she was a working woman in the 1940s and 1950s, and she got up every day, and she went into the makeup chair early so her kids could sleep in. She all had her stuff always shot the latest so that they could go home. You know, she worked a long day, and she did not know how to cook to save her life. She smoked like a chimney from the time she was 8 years old. you know, she was really a dame in the best way.
Yeah.
But knew how to rock a simple black dress and pearls too. Very. I really admired her so much. She was sort of one of my. We became great friends. We were not close when I was very young, mm-hmm. but we became really good friends towards the end. I'm
so glad you have that.
I'm so lucky, right? And her story, you know, she literally grew up on trains with the drawers pulled out, sleeping in them because her parents were in vaudeville. There's actually, I was going to tell you guys, I did Grease on, you know, the Love Boat of Broadway in New York and on the road for a long time. And we went to one of the Orpheum theaters, mm-hmm. and I think it was in Memphis. But they have on their walls pictures of everybody who's ever played there. And my whole family was there. I had my grandma and grandpa had done Marriage Go Round in the 70s. Mm-hmm. My dad was there, had played there. My brothers had played there. They had a rock band in the 90s. And my great grandmother and her sister, who were vaudeville twins, Harriet and Hattie McNutt, had there was a picture of them on the wall. It was amazing. I mean, they had a million pictures, but
no, but it's your entire history.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Your family tree is on a wall in a theater.
And it was really very. That makes me feel very warm and cozy, knowing that I have that connection with this thing that I love so much. And it's not so much about, and you probably experience this too. It's like loving it from the inside out. It's like loving the makings of the machinations and mm-hmm. and honoring that, not so much the flash that you see on the flim-flam, like my grandma used to say, but the flim-flam part of it. Mm-hmm. It's really what was under that. You know, she used to tell stories about Ginger working with Fred, and mm-hmm. you see this effortless just breeze won't go by on your screen. But the reality was, she'd go through three pairs of shoes when they rehearsed.
Oh, they,
yeah.
Just soaking with blood. And. Yep. You know, they'd have these huge fights because he hated the bugle beads when she would have the dresses. Because one bead on the floor and your taps and you're flying, you know. And you just the work to make it look like that is, you know.
But that's what part of why we prefer a lot of the older stuff, and I say we as in our family, is because they don't make it look like work. And one of the things that drives us nuts sometimes
is a
lot of artists today want you to see the sweat. They want you to see, do you see me, mama? You see what I'm doing? You know, it's too much. I love that when I watch Fred, Gene, any of those, you know, and Ginger, true, I love her so much.
I do too.
You know, you watch them and it's joy.
Yeah.
Now, knowing what we do now, and hearing about the amount of work and the blood and the everything else that went into it, holy mm-hmm. cow! But the end result performance, it's perfect.
Now, your dad, Ricky,
was
a low key performer.
Oh yeah,
and so he absorbed that strain of performance art. You know, he never broke a sweat. It seemed
he sang with his eyes closed, and he always used to say it was because he was really scared mm-hmm. of the audience. He was a really private guy mm-hmm. and really sensitive guy mm-hmm. and kind, you know, good guy, like really the kind of guy that you know is not long for this earth, because he just doesn't get it. He never got in the fray, which was very hard to have as a dad, because you want someone who's in the fray once in a while. Mm-hmm. He was sort of more like a kind of a poet, kind of that was sort of his thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, he was an artist.
Yeah.
And I get frustrated sometimes because people don't really know that about him. They think he was, in fact, one of the, I think, most brave thing he ever did was, you know, get out from under Ozzy's sort of strong control mm-hmm. and say, I'm making my own music now. Yeah. I'm singing my own stuff, you know. I have, Rhino Records Bear Family, sorry, did a really great box set of mm-hmm. his stuff, and they have all the studio tapes. Mm-hmm. So Ozzy was always there when he was recording for the TV show.
Right.
And you hear the conversations they would have back and forth.
Oh, wow.
And there's this one song he did called Hello Mary Lou, and mm-hmm. the percussion on that song is just a cowbell. And Ozzy kept saying, I want a drum. You need a drum. And you hear the actual discussion back and forth and the argument. And here he was, this he was, I guess, 18 at the time, just very quietly digging in his heels, and it's like, no pop, no drum, just cowbell. And it was really cool. I'm so lucky to have, you know, don't have my dad anymore, don't have my grandparents. My children never knew their grandfather, mm-hmm. Rick, mm-hmm. but they have this film and this music,
yeah.
you know?
It's Goodbye Heart?
Yeah.
Hello Mary Lou, Goodbye Heart, yeah.
It's all in there somewhere.
Testing my memory, that's all.
There you go.
Just testing my memory.
And
again, just to reemphasize, what your grandfather did was he snuck rock and roll
yes.
onto mainstream primetime television.
That was really my dad who insisted on that. Mm-hmm. But see, because he had been a band leader, mm-hmm. he was really open to all kinds of music.
Mm-hmm.
So they had great music in the house all the time. Mm-hmm. And he was playing Carl Perkins and Chuck Berry and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Grandma used to say that they lived right up here on Camino Palmero.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to say that beautiful house up there, that the plaster, this old Victorian house, would rain down on the dining room table because he would be playing the drums, because he started playing the drums.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all great kinds of, but the radio stations at that time wouldn't play it. It was, you know, as I said, called race music, and mm-hmm. they just wouldn't play it. And they got so much hate mail. They did Fats Domino's I'm Walkin' was the first thing my dad sang on the show. And there was hate mail from everywhere. And the network said, we have to take that episode out. You cannot play that music. It's rock and roll. You can't play it. And Ozzy was like, sorry, I'm playing what I like. This
and
is good
that
music.
Song especially, that's barely rock music.
Yeah.
That's about as pleasant as it gets.
Well, yes. Yes.
No, I'm just saying it's that was how reactive people were.
Rhythm and blues.
It wasn't Joe Turner or anything.
No, but that's how they reacted.
Yes,
and that's
right.
So fascinating.
Absolutely. And, yeah. and you know, I really give my grandparents a lot of credit for standing up for that. And as I was saying, you know, sort of smuggling that music. And someone said at the Rock Hall induction way back when that parents didn't like Elvis, kids didn't like Pat Boone, but they both liked Ricky.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, no offense to Pat Boone or Elvis.
No. No, when I grew up, the idea of Ricky Nelson was the Elvis you could bring home.
Right.
That's what he was, is he was the one you could bring home to mom.
You know, I just got to say, this is the kind of guy he was. Someone recently just told me this story. They were driving down Sunset. He was driving down Hollywood Boulevard, and he was probably about 18. And he said that this guy was telling me the story, said, I pulled up to a stoplight and I was on a first date with this girl. And I pulled up and there's your dad in the car next to us in his brand new convertible. And the girl started to go a little crazy. And the guy looked over, it's sort of like in a panic. And my dad apparently sussed out what was happening and said, hey, good to see you again. I'll see you. We'll play tennis again soon, okay? See you later. And the guy was like, you know, from then on, I was in with this girl.
Wow.
And I love that about him. He was just
that's wonderful.
That's great.
Person.
That's
great.
Wonderful. Two of your brothers, of course, became Nelson.
Yes.
Gunnar and Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
And
the most beautiful hair you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah, they had good hair. That's
true. Oh, my God. That's what, when I think of them, that is the very first. It's this long blonde magic.
Was it predestined that you go into show business, you think?
No, I wanted to be a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. And I was really good in school. And I think it was what happened, you know, and again, Jesse, you probably can relate to this, but it's a bit like when you are in the business from the time you're little and sort of surrounded by it. It's kind of like movies. I guess the expression is it's a busman's holiday when it's like entertainment stops being entertaining like it is for some people. You're looking mm-hmm. at things that, well, anyway.
Now, when you're from a farming town, you farm, and when you're from Los Angeles, you work in the entertainment industry.
That's right. That's right.
That is, I tell people, whenever they say, did you always want to do this? Was this always something? Being a PA was most
exactly.
was my first job, most of my friends' first jobs.
Right, exactly.
That was it.
And that's what happened to me. I had done commercials as a kid. I paid for my car and some mm-hmm. other things. And when I came back from New York, I was at Bard College there, and I decided to come back and live with my grandmother. And I was going to go back to school here. I needed to make some extra money. So it was sort of like, all right, I'll grab an agent and start going on auditions, and maybe I'll get another little thing that I can
mm-hmm.
earn. I was never expected to be a career, but I got this show, Square Pegs. It was my first job, really.
And that show spoke to a generation mm-hmm. of young people.
You know,
people.
One of the best things that's ever happened to me was in the 90s on Halloween, I opened the door and there was a little girl standing there and she was me.
As,
and I said, well, who are you? She said, I'm Jennifer DiNuccio from Square Pegs. I was like, oh my gosh, I can die now. This is fantastic.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It was really
that's
fun.
That's wonderful. It made a real impact though.
It did.
And you did too.
Oh gosh. Well, you know, a funny thing about that is I did this character based on the girls I went to school with. You know, they all kind of like talk like this.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. And then and the wardrobe lady called me and said, you know, Moon Zappa just put out a song. This is after we shot the pilot. And she sounds just like your character. And suddenly everyone was saying I was doing a bad Valley Girl impression. Like, no, I was first.
Darrers. No.
I love Moon, though. She's very sweet.
That's great.
But and with that, though, you've got Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yes.
And again, and just in terms of being around as...
And Jamie Gertz and...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. As a whole, it's a laundry list of people.
And they were producers from Saturday Night Live. It wasn't like a studio kind of thing, creature. It was, you know, it wasn't Facts of Life, who we made fun of all the time on Square Pegs. It was sort of this New York kind of avant-garde, weird sense. I never would have gotten cast as the popular girl in one of those shows because I was funny looking. I mean, I had sort of this nose and this short hair and spiky and, you know, I was not Heather Locklear, which is what everyone wanted at that particular time and place. But, you know, they were different and brave and unique. I mean, the show was about two unpopular, not so attractive girls.
Yeah.
So... Anyway, I love Ann Beats, and, you know, we got to work with Bill Murray, and some really, you know, Devo came and did our show,
yeah.
And it was really fun. We had Bill Murray came, and he did an episode, and he played a teacher, and he took the script in front of the classroom. We're all ready to go. Very carefully took the brads out of the script. Those are the, for people who don't know, the rivets in the script. And he threw it up in the air, and he said, we're not doing this. And everyone, you know, the director who was from TV, like network TV, freaked out. And he ended up going up and picking her up and throwing her over his shoulder and running around the room saying, improv, improv, we're going improv. So.
My.
It was
fun. I can't imagine. The suits just going.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons for our demise is we were too far away from the suits. They didn't like it. We shot in Downey.
Interesting.
So
In Downey.
So I would get up every morning and my
why?
It was cheap.
Okay.
They had a school there. We shot in a real school.
There you go.
And man, it was far every day. It was getting up in the dark. I was living with my dad at that time and Errol Flynn's ghost. To tell you about Errol Flynn.
I was going to ask you about that.
You were?
Oh,
yes,
he's so,
yes, because there's that book, you know, Errol Flynn Slept Here.
Oh, yeah. Did Rory Flynn write that book?
No. That's the one written by Robert Mattson, who's a friend of mine.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did I talk to him about this?
I don't remember if you're interviewed in the book or not.
Got some good stories about Errol.
Errol, who built secret passageways in the house.
Should I tell the story?
Yes.
Go ahead.
The Errol Flynn had a house that was called The Farm, and it was just a ranch house, really, not hugely big or anything like that, in a gorgeous location up on Mulholland Drive near Outpost, and it overlooked the whole valley, so it was really, and it had a barn and a pool and a tennis court and a believe it or not, a cockfighting ring, which is pretty
important. Important to
yes,
have.
Yes, in the 1940s.
Never know when you might need it.
That's right. And he would have these crazy parties there. And it's actually, you know, in SOB when they dress up the body, and that's based on the John Barrymore story.
Mm-hmm. Right,
they
right.
threw him in the pool, and they took it. Do you know this story, Jess? So they took John Barrymore's body, Errol Flynn and David Niven, and someone else.
Depends on which telling you believe.
Yes. Oh, okay.
There are many variations on this saga.
This is what I heard, but could be wrong. And they had a party for him at the house. So anyway, a lot of crazy stories. And the house was always, my grandpa Ozzy almost bought it in the 40s when it came up for sale. And my dad had seen it as a kid and always loved it. He had a thing about being up high on a hill. He wanted to be up high on a hill. So we ended up buying this house, and, you know, it was notoriously haunted. And nobody really believed that stuff. It had secret passageways, and it had weird little peepholes everywhere. And I lived in Beverly Adlin's room. She was Errol Flynn's very underaged mistress.
Right.
And there was a peephole in my floor, and you could look down through the peephole, and the mirror above the fireplace was tilted, so you could literally see the whole breadth of the house. You could see who was there. There was a two-way mirror, a big giant one, like the whole ceiling, in tiles above the master bed, and there was not just a mirror, it was a two-way mirror. So there was an attic space you could go up, and Flynn used to have bets with, it was very, actually kind of dark. You know, people would say that he was a Nazi sympathizer, and there was a lot of kind of crazy going-ons up there. The house had that feeling. My dad used to say if Flynn was a Nazi, it was because he liked the uniform. But, you know, we kind of got used to things literally going bump in the night, and things opening and closing, and the animals not going in certain rooms. And then slowly my friends wouldn't sleep over anymore. I'd be like, oh, that's just the ghost. You know, the shutter would fly up in the middle of the night. Things would move. You'd put something down, and then you'd find it over there. And then I had an experience where I really think I talked to him. And I know I'm from L.A., and it's going to sound like I'm crazy, but I had had pneumonia, and I was in that sort of state, you know, like not sleep, but...
Yeah.
And in my head, I kind of walked down the stairs, and you could see all the way to my dad's, Errol's old office, and right through to it, and he was standing in front of the fireplace, Errol Flynn, and he had a tux on, and he had a martini glass, and he raised it, and he said, Happy New Year. And this, of course, was nowhere near New Year's. So when I kind of came out of this, sort of, I thought I was dreaming. I was actually I had gone down the stairs in my nightgown, but I was feverish and stuff like that. But the really creepy thing about it, and it seemed so real that I actually talked to him, was that my dad died on New Year's Eve about 7 years later. And I always remembered, I even wrote it in my journal, you know. And when he died, it was almost like who he was kept all this negativity and creepiness at bay. It just went nuts in that house. And it was a really bad house. Actually, I had done a movie with Richard Dreyfuss, and he called to say, hey, the house is for sale now that your dad is gone. And I said, don't buy it. It's a bad, bad house.
Wow.
And my experience with the ghost, one night I came home, and my dad was on the road with his girlfriend, I went up to my room, and I heard all this crazy stuff going on in the room below me, which was this big, giant, like a gallery of a closet, and it had my dad's gold records on the wall, and it sounded like someone was smashing them all. You could hear glass breaking. Oh, I'm getting chills. I always get chills when I tell this story, and you could feel the thuds against the wall, like the wall was vibrating. It sounded like someone was throwing something against the wall. I thought we were being robbed. So I went into my closet, and I hid there until you know, got really quiet, and like a couple hours went by. And I went downstairs, and by this time it was night. My dad's dog and two cats were locked in the master bedroom from the inside with the lights on, and nothing else had been touched in the house. Everything was exactly pristine. I thought I was coming down into devastation.
Right.
And I left shortly thereafter. I was doing Square Pegs at the time, and just, you know, it's just too much for me. I can't deal with it anymore, especially when he was out of town. And then shortly before he passed away, his girlfriend called it one day and said, you know, the weirdest thing happened last night. We were downstairs, and up in your room, we heard this crazy noise going on, and, you know, we called the police, and they came. My room was locked from the inside with all the lights on, and nothing was touched. I mean, it's just a creepy house.
Yeah.
And
gone now.
It's gone now. Yeah. Yeah, which it should be. Yeah. It really was a not a good house.
Yeah.
But
wow.
Oh, do you know about the ghost, because you said Sara Bonita, or where the studio is.
Yes.
The up on Sierra Bonita by Camino Palmero, which is where the folks, the grandparents lived. There was a stagecoach stop there at one point, apparently, and in the 40s, they built a bus stop, and two people got killed jumping into the road to avoid the specter of a stagecoach coming down the street.
Gosh.
and then just disappearing into nothing.
This has turned into a very different podcast.
Yeah, right?
But I think we should go off in this direction. I don't know.
Sorry. I just think it's, you know, if any of that stuff is going to happen, it's going to be here, because it's such a land of dreams and emotions and unrequited feelings. And, you know, I think that's where all that comes
from. Every time one of my friends says they're looking at a house in Los Feliz, I said, just check just the history not, on it
yeah,
real quick.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I feel like someone was killed in all of them. So just consider, you know, maybe.
So, but you have made your way, your own way, and your own reputation. I mean, no one who fell in love with you on Square Pegs fell in love with you because you were Ricky Nelson's daughter or Ozzie and Harriet's granddaughter.
Because
you were good.
Well, thank you. Well, I think I have the advantage of not being overwhelmed on a, because, you know, like you, Jesse, I get on a soundstage and I'm really at home. Mm-hmm. And you see people who are young get very overwhelmed sometimes by the whole experience of it, and it's too much, or maybe they're making a lot of money all at once and they don't know how to handle it. And it was just sort of like, you know, this is a, my family didn't even really care that I was doing a TV show. It was kind of like, all right, well, oh, yeah, sure. So, thank you for saying that. But I kind of became, after doing Down and Out, which is really my only sort of real claim to fame
Down
as,
and out
as
Beverly
a film.
Hills.
Yes, right. Down and Out in Beverly Hills. We did this one time, at the Academy Awards show. There were a bunch of us, and it was a really not a good broadcast, but there were a bunch of us that were doing a dance number. Mm-hmm. And it was a bunch of people, young people from in the business. And Corey Feldman, he was going through a very obnoxious period at that time. Mm-hmm. He stood on the top of the stairs where we were rehearsing, and he said, "I'm the only one in this group who's had a number one movie." And I'm in the back, and I just kind of put up my hand. I'm like, I did.
Excuse me, sir. I was number one
for a long time.
We haven't even talked about your mom and her artwork.
Yeah, the Harmons. That's a whole other thing.
You have another.
And my grandma Elise was at Universal. She was in The Curse of the Mummies,
too. Yes, yes, yes. My dad, so we took a picture so you could see. This is in our house.
No.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I've never seen that one before. Oh, that's so cool.
For anyone listening, I will include these photos when I post when I post it, so you can at least find some.
Elise Knox was a beautiful, I guess you used to call it starlet in the 40s, but an actress who worked mostly in B-movies.
Yep.
She was in the Joe Palooka series.
Joe Palooka's girl, yeah.
And
in The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, she's on that like sort of iconic poster where he's carrying around the damsel.
Yep.
And was that
Lon Chaney Jr., right? And she married Tom Harmon, All-American football star and hero, and who later became a popular sportscaster. And their daughter, Kristen, became your mom.
Yep. And she was in an Academy Award winning short, by the way.
Johnny Crawford
short. Your dad's, both of you guys, your brains are just...
So you have this incredible family history that goes on in 17 different
directions.
You did forget the next step of Mark Harmon in terms of TV.
Yeah.
NCIS Mark Harmon.
Yeah, Mark kind of runs things these days.
He does, right? He really does. But so, it is overwhelming how many family members you've got.
But to get back to you.
Right.
Do you still enjoy acting?
I do. I do so much. I really, really do a lot of voice work now, and I do a lot of since I had my kids. But, you know, I've done so many of those, you know, women in – I'm either killing someone or being killed on Lifetime. I do a lot of little independent films. In fact, I just played Theda Bara, an older Theda Bara, when she was a little rough around the edges in her late 40s, which was really fun in a little movie called As Long as I'm Famous, a little indie. And it was so interesting researching her because, you know, she's got this image, and she was, you know, actually Theodosia Burr was her name, not Theodosia Burr. That's the
Theodosia
president's
Goodman.
Daughter.
Yeah.
Aaron Burr's daughter. Yes, Theodosia Goodman. And her voice, she had this very sort of tinny little voice like this when you hear on the radio. Mm-hmm. And somehow didn't equate. I did it a lot better than that in the film. it didn't equate with those eyes and the vampies.
Yes, the image was very much as we were talking about reality versus perception of reality.
Oh, yeah. I love those stories, though, don't
sure.
you?
Sure. Yeah. She was invented.
You say that, though. In my head, I just hear, and I can't stand him.
I can't stand him.
Yeah. That's the... Isn't it though? That's exactly it.
Exactly.
Oh, what a beautiful this vampy woman. And I can't stand him.
But you know, because you've made an impression on people, whether you realize it or not, you really have.
Well, I've had a struggle with cancer in my life, and I've had three different
kinds. All the cancers.
I've had all of them, and I've kind of made that a little bit of a focus too.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. But I really, coming from you, that I can't tell you how much that means. I mean, I figure I'm kind of a journeyman at this point, and mm-hmm. I love doing character stuff, and I love being on the set. Period. Mm-hmm. I just love working, mm-hmm. and now I find I just did a little independent film, and the sound guy came up to me with a little mic, and he was talking to someone, and he just stuck his hand right in my dress and started. Mm-hmm. And I smacked his hand, and I realized I've become that sort of the broad on the set who's like saying, "Hey, no,
you got to teach him.
Mind your manners.
You got to teach him.
Yeah.
All they have to do is say, where can I put this?
Exactly.
I'm going to reach here.
And you know, it was great. He came up, and he was like 12 or something. Right. You know, but he came up after the shoot, and he's, I want to thank you because I really didn't learn this stuff. You know,
but that's just it. Someone has to teach
someone
them,
has to
and
teach
you've
you.
Taught him, and he won't forget that.
And maybe he'll teach someone else.
Exactly, It has to be passed along.
It does,
as you have learned from your family, and now you're going to teach another generation. Younger people. Who need to be told?
Well,
how to behave.
You're living my dream because you're a professor, mm-hmm. and I would mm-hmm. do anything to be a teacher, to have gone into teaching anything, mm-hmm. whether it be dance or history or mm-hmm. anything. I love, my kids just go la la la, put their fingers in their ears, like, oh no, she's off on another story. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important, and especially in Hollywood, mm-hmm. in Hollywood being a metaphor and an actual place. It's so important because things move so fast and change so fast, and nobody wants to hear about. I always thought someone should go around and interview, and it might be too late for this now, an interview. I had this thought in the 90s, but go and interview the makeup and the hairstylists who are aging out.
Oh, they know all the stories.
Who have all the stories.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's the, was it The Women He Undressed? Is that the book?
Yeah.
Or the doc.
About Ori Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, have you heard of this one?
No.
You want some really fantastic dirt.
Documentary.
It's a documentary, but also a book, isn't it?
Yes, there's also a book.
And Ori Kelly he dressed and undressed everyone. Yeah. And
had
it's
like 300 screen credits, yeah. three Oscars.
Oh, wow.
Something crazy like that. And it's
everything.
But that is it. But see, again, though, I do think that part of it is when you grow up on a set, I grew up at E.T., mm-hmm. and I would listen to everything. And I loved it. I didn't like to sit on the stage. I'd like to go into the editing bay because you can heckle.
Do you know Chris Clark? Do you remember Chris Clark?
Oh, yeah. Chris is at E.T. for a while.
That's my son's dad.
There you go.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is a game Chris, we're playing.
I met Chris because he came to interview me from E.T.
Oh,
wow.
My gosh.
Isn't that crazy?
That's such
a world.
It's
smaller
a tiny world.
Smaller.
What does Stephen Wright say? It's a small world, but I wouldn't want to paint it.
That's it. I think that when you grow up in that situation, it is the comfiest and the most fun.
Yeah.
And you want to hear every story.
Yeah.
I do.
Absolutely.
I want to hear everything.
Yes, and when you're little and you can kind of lurk in the corners and you see, what it really takes, and you can take the air out of some things and you can sort of respect other things and the work of other things. I love that whole part of it, and I'm sad that I find the younger generation. I'm just finding that when I work with actors who are younger, I did this one movie recently where all of the actresses on it was about a whole bunch of girls in high school, and I was the mom. And all these girls were picked from Instagram. None of them had acted. Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
None of them had acted before in their lives. And the whole entire thing was me literally just being so crabby about, they were on their phones doing off camera. I kept thinking about what my grandma Harriet would have said to me.
Oh, smacked them.
Smacked
them.
Yes.
Now, did you learn anything working with Mary Wicks?
Mary Wicks was the best.
Now, you worked with Tom Bosley and Mary Wicks on the Father Dowling Mysteries.
You know, there's a funny thing. One time we were at the ABC affiliates in New York, and it was the time of Twin Peaks and all these other very cool shows.
Right.
And, you know, I come around the corner, and there's all these different shows, and the Twin Peaks people are like, they're like in black, and they're smoking their Gitan cigarettes and looking very mysterious. And there's Tom, and he's wearing like a, you know, this really funky old suit that didn't really fit him very well. And just, you know, I kind of was like, but he's the real deal. He's the guy that did Broadway, that knows his stuff. And we used to get into fights, though, because, well, we got into fights all the time, but... because I was being a purist about working, and we were in Denver working really in miserable, so cold. It was the coldest winter the first year that they'd ever had in Denver, like 100 years. The film, because we would film then, was see, I am old. It was breaking outside. Like, the guys would like have to put their coats on it and stuff to keep it from breaking. But Tom just wanted to get done and get home. And I would be like, but what's my motivation? I don't know why I'm doing this. And one day I've never said this out loud before since then. I'm embarrassed I'm going to even admit this, but I actually went to my trailer. It was the one time I did ever in my whole entire life, because I couldn't understand why the director wanted me to do a particular thing. Mm. And Tom, you know, it was like that thing we were talking about with Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, where he's just like, stand up, you say the line, and you sit down, you know? He used saltier words than that. And I started crying. I mean, we were both tired and it was late, but I was like, but I need to know why. And if I don't know why, then I should just go home, because that's my job. And I sort of went off in this, you know, artistic huff to the trailer. Of course, we're doing a silly TV show. But,
it
yes.
still matters. Yeah.
We had our run-ins big time. But it was on screen. It kind of looked like we really liked each other. So that's all that matters.
Acting. That's all.
And Mary Wicks?
Sorry. Mary was just the anchor in a good way of the show. And she would dress me down every time she got, because I was a whippersnapper. Mm-hmm. I was a whippersnapper. And she would always tell me how my character wouldn't say this, wouldn't do that. And I just loved it. I loved being berated by Mary, because I learned so much from her, you know? And she was always, okay, kid, come over here. Let me tell you something. You never let them sign you out in pencil. Never. Because they're going to change it. They're going to change your time. Always sign out in pen. So, you know, things like that, you know? And she just was, I just soaked all that up. And we had one episode where my grandma Harriet came, and she had known Mary from RKO days, and Mary and Lucy, of course, were great friends. Mm-hmm. Grandma had always wanted to play a nun that got slightly tipsy on sacramental wine. So they specifically wrote that in, and my grandma played a nun. She was raised by nuns. Well, her parents were on the road, and they both were making rum cakes, and they both get drunk in the scene. And it was really fun. It was really fun to watch that, you know,
I'll bet.
Yeah.
Tracy, it's been so nice having you here.
Thank you. And, Professor Malton, thank you so much.
Thank you for that honor of calling me that. I consider it such. And you're just fun to talk to. And it's so neat to dive into your family history, and that you keep it alive is wonderful.
Well, that means so much to me, coming from you, and I feel like
Malton on Movies is sponsored today by Legion M, the first fan entertainment company.
We are.
They've got a lot of good stuff going on, and you can learn about it at legionm.com.
And you guys are doing that, so thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here. Share your table.
Share our table. Let's talk of Nelson's.
Are you a social media person?
Yes, I am.
And where do people follow you?
Well, okay. I have to say, I'm only a Facebook person.
That's okay.
Nothing wrong with that.
I tried the other, and it just was down rabbit holes every day, and I was wasting too much of my life. Mm-hmm. So I'm on a hiatus from the Instagram.
As many people are.
Okay.
As many people for good reason. But we wish you well.
Thank you so much.
And we hope to see you again sometime soon.
Thank you.
And Jesse, where do people find us?
You are at Leonard Malton. I am at Jesse Malton on Twitter and Instagram. And you can go to leonardmalton.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
That is true. And it's true that we'll be back again next week. Thank you so much for listening, folks. Bye-bye.